accession number 27226, Reel 4.
Lionel Hook, Reel 4.
Okay. Right, well, we've got this business of being a pilot out of the way, and we're sent home on leave. Devonport was really only a story of bombs, but the one thing I do remember about it, of course, that we went ashore, used to go ashore, and this was a bombing night, and I went to the main street in Plymouth. You know Plymouth at all? You wouldn't know it now anyway, because it's all been redeveloped. But we went to a cinema, it was a stage show of some sort of kind. And the bombing was pretty rough, it was getting pretty bad. And the manager of the place came along and said, "Well, sorry, there's an air raid on. You can stay in here if you want to, or if you want to go home, you can go home. But he said, it's very bad outside and do what you want." And I decided that I'd go back to barracks. So I went outside this palace of variety, call it that, and I was standing underneath the glass place, and I heard some bombs coming down. You know, the aircraft over dropping bombs. And I had to make a quick decision, because that was no place when bombs were around. Either I go across the road, this is a crossroads here, the main street was here, and this is a side street. And I remember particularly a very tall wall across there, and across the road were shops. I thought, well, it's no good being underneath this glass thing. So instead of going underneath that wall, I thought they dropped a bomb on that, I'd be covered in bricks. I went across the road and fell underneath the window of a shop. At that time, the bombs were dropped and they came across the crossroads, right across here, 1, 2, 3, 4. Shattered the place, shattered the glass, covered me in glass. And I was semi-conscious, because I remember where I went to, but I don't remember much more. And I had a naval oilskin. I was wearing oilskin. And I went along, away from there, shook all the glass out, to find a place to go. And I got into a cafe, which was full of people, and found a table. And I fell across the table and fell asleep with my back to an electric fire. And my oilskin caught fire for a start. And so they stopped that. And when they took the oilskin off, I don't remember, but I walked all the way back to Devonport Barracks, and I knew nothing at all about it. And to this day, I couldn't tell you how to get to Devonport Barracks from that main street, which has obviously been developed. I don't even know the entrances. But I got back, and I'm a survivor, obviously, because that was a bomb blast. I got a battering anyway, for what it's worth. And that was sort of safety number two. They didn't bomb the theatre, but that wall didn't come down, but all along here was quite messy, and a lot of people in that. I remember there were wrens and all sorts in that particular cafe place at the time, and that's all I do remember. Don't remember going back to barracks. And I don't remember much about the rest, except because of the bombing, we're all sent on leave, and I went home again. And I went home with obviously a draft sheet, a rail ticket to go back to Pompey. And I went to Pompey Barracks, which again was being bombed.
Can I ask you actually, Lionel, at that time, travelling in wartime at that stage during the Blitz?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes.
How did it occur, and how hard was it to travel around?
The trains were running all the time, but every so often the railway lines, especially in the south, were changed. For instance, to get from Shotley to Devonport, which was the trip that we did, we were diverted almost back to Birmingham. That was quite a messy trip. I can't give you the details, but we arrived at Devonport, you know, at night, and we were transported. There was no real problem. We got from A to B. Later on, when we went home, we had a railway warrant. I got on the train there and went to... I didn't go across country. I think I went from Devonport to London, to King's Cross, and going to the London North Eastern, going up to Hull, changed in Hull. And this is all interim stuff. It's away from there. But that particular night, bear in mind that the Blitz was ongoing, I got to Hull too late to catch the last train home to Bridlington, which is 30 miles, and the Salvation Army were there, and I slept on the railway platform in Hull. That night, and bear in mind that I'd just been from Devonport where I'd been bombed. I don't think anything of it. It's not, you know, but it's... I remember it as part of my life. Travelling up in the train from King's Cross north, we walked all the way, we stood all the way. If anybody wanted to pee where it was a wren, they were carried across the people who were standing all the way back home. That was a memory to remember. I got out at Hull and had to wait for the 6 o'clock train in the morning. It shows the state I was in, because I slept through the whole of the bombing of Hull that night, where they actually dropped a bomb across the road from the railway station in the on the hospital there. And I know Kingston, because I was doing studies there. I walked out of Hull station to go out to see what it was all about. And I walked up the road that I knew. I can't remember the name of it now. That's where my memory's failing a little bit. But I walked up that street and got lost in Hull. And that was 100 yards. The bricks all over the place. It was a mess. And an airplane, fully laden with bombs, had gone into the hospital, which was just across the way from the station. He just accepted that, and that was it, you know. I was going home, so I went back to the station, got a train, and went home. Nothing untoward there, except I did actually go back to the... Because I wanted to fly, and I was in the Navy now, I went along to the RAF, and they let me... They flew me around in a Blenny.
Was that on leave?
On leave, yes.
So where did you fly from?
At Catfoss, down where I used to go and watch the aircraft. They didn't call it Catfoss then. It was it was quite a big airfield then. Quite a prominent one. I remember. It begins with L. Anyway, I went down, and I believe I made a note of that in my logbook anyway.
What did you think when you took that flight in the Blenheim? What did you think about the Blenheim as an aircraft?
Oh, just a flight in an aeroplane, period. I wasn't impressed one way or another. It didn't leave any positive impression at all. It was just I could go in the aeroplane and be flown, and that was it. It was just a round, you know, quick trip really, five bob flight more than anything else. But it kept, you know, it's amazing what you could do if you ask, you know. And I got away with it. Went home. That was the time when the bomb. That's when the time. The railwayman got the George Cross in Bridlington as well as Hull. We were being bombed then. But the place was fairly desolate. There's none of my pals there, except, as far as I was concerned, we had six WAF billeted. All the WAF were being trained in Bridlington, and at the Spa Royal Hall, they were living in the Royal Hall there. So that was a bit of a ball, because I was 21 years old and I knew what it was about. So that was fine, you know. And really, that was about it, more than anything else.
How did it feel, though? Because all the places that you've gone through are being bombed and raided by the German Air Force at that time. So, you know, did you have any feelings towards how the war was going with all this bombing, or...?
Not really, no, because they were really over flying Bridlington, and we knew that. But they were getting the end of it all, and they dropped an odd bomb here and an odd bomb there. But it made a bit of a bloody mess, you know. But we thought we knew what was happening in other places, and of course I didn't worry because I'd been struck down in Devonport and later on to Pompey when I came back again. So you didn't know really what was happening. You knew that we were being bombed. It was pretty bloody hard, and it was even worse. You see, that was, you see, the, we're talking about January 40, well, 41. I was down at Vincent then, and that was at Gosport, and that in itself is another story. But memory of Bridlington was really just going home, seeing how the family lived. My father was in the Home Guard. I don't remember very much about it. We lived all right. Dad knew a lot of farmers, I suppose. That made a bit of a difference. But people carried on as normally. They were all, you know, semi-starving, really, because there wasn't a lot of food around, and it was Christmas time anyway. The rations were adequate, and they got there, which was the main thing. So it was part of it. And people always found a way to get in a little bit extra. And I suppose being in an agrarian community, the people would be bottling plums and, you know, doing all the things. So things like, you know, you don't think about it now because they come from the shop. But there then, with a war on and living where there were apple trees and the farmers and everything else, put things down and bottle it and everything else. And that was part of life anyway in those days, that people lived a bottled fruit. They always bought their own fruit. And my mum was quite a competent character, really. She kept four kids going. She kept us all right. So that was doing well. Of course, she had my sister was evacuated to the big museum now in North Yorkshire. They were sent there, but the other two kids, they were growing up. They stayed at school, at home, and my second eldest brother, he went into the army as a squaddy. He was a bit sick anyway. But my younger brother, he had his arm blown off. I told him, didn't I? So that was a bit sad. That was after I'd gone abroad. So really, I've done Devonport in a quickie. Devonport was a transient situation.
Well, then you moved back down to Portsmouth, didn't you?
I moved back to Portsmouth. In Pompey, they were bombed, and they didn't know what to do with people because they had masses of naval ratings waiting ships to go to and everything else. They had no real organisation to talk about. You can't organise groups of people who come in en masse when the place is being bombed. So what they did, everybody went out on the parade ground every day and were marching up and down all the time. Nothing else but that. You were a fairly free agent once you weren't in a group. You were in barracks. We slept in tunnels underneath the parade ground, which was a bit hairy because if they dropped a bomb on it, caught people. They didn't drop a bomb while I was there, but they did at Vincent while I was there. They caught one, of course, later on. But Vincent's a different ball game. At Pompey Barracks, you were slinging hammocks. You were just filling in time, really. You never got any pay, and I managed to get one stack of cash. I waited days out a little hole in the wall to get, you know, about a week's pay so I could buy something in the naffy. So we were living on scam, really. It was
conditions sound quite hard, actually.
Pardon?
Conditions sound quite hard in the...
Oh, they were very, very primitive because there was no naval organisation operating except to move masses of people from A to B. And once they got there, they had to come under the control of people and their own devices. And I don't remember being taught anything at Pompey Barracks. We did one thing, I remember particularly, they bombed the Catholic church, or where the priest lived as well, and we had to go round and tidy up the house for him. And I particularly remember, particularly in relation to the Catholic church, which, I don't know, are you a Catholic? But Catholics never moved individually. They're always moved by the church, and the church records went with them. And we knew more about some girls who would come from Ireland, who were living in Portsmouth, who were prostitutes. And they were recorded by the church there. They knew them. They knew everything they did. Their church records were, you know, and they never let any go from the church if they could stop it, you know. There were no backsliders in the in church. It was an eye-opener. And that, of course, was a the bishopric for the Catholic Church in that part of the world. They got a bit of a battering. And so that was something I learned very, very quickly. I remember one particularly, in looking at the records of one particular girl who was a bit naughty, and how she was only young, she was quite young, she'd transferred from Ireland and come over here. And of course their interest was keeping them in the Catholic Church and supporting the Catholic Church in her own way. That was a revelation. But going ashore was in the barracks. That was going ashore. Has anybody told you about going ashore in barrack life? Well, when you're in the Navy, there's stone frigates, and it's a ship on the shore, and you take a liberty boat to go ashore, you know. You parade outside, and the petty officer tells you where you can go, where you can't go, what's in bounds and what's out of bounds. You can't smuggle tobacco. Well, they're probably smuggling it all the bloody time. And then when the time comes, you're allowed out of the gates. And you can stay out as long as you like, doing whatever you like. But you've got to be back at 6 o'clock. Pissed out of your mind if necessary, but you come back at 6 o'clock. Come back after. If you miss your ship, you're in jankers and you get punished. And that's universal in the Navy, even to the day. If you miss your ship, you've got a problem. And it's an interesting fact of life that the Navy is pragmatic. If you're a sailor or an officer and your ship sails and you've missed it, you can get back onto that ship however you like. And if you get back on the ship, nobody will bother. And there's people will get them to hire boats, hire power boats, and chase after the ship. People know somebody that's in the Fleet Air Arm now, they've got a chopper, they get a chopper and go on back on board, and they're all right. But if they miss the ship, they're buggered. You did not know that. Did you ever know that? Yeah. That was a clever trick, you know. When
you were ashore in Portsmouth, I'm thinking of
Aggie Westerns. Went to Aggie Westerns, yes.
What was that like?
I don't know. We used to go to Aggie Westerns. I'm supporter of Aggie Westerns in Pompey now. But it was the place you went to. It's like the Salvation Army. Has anybody ever told you the Salvation Army? About the Salvation Army? Well, Aggie Westerns was like the Salvation Army. If you were there, the Salvation Army were there. And I'll tell you a story that's almost unbelievable. I was as far forward as you can go in Burma later on in the war, and the Salvation Army were giving me cups of tea with women there as well. They were quite incredible. You know, they were everywhere. And when you came home at the station, if you know, we missed a train or you wanted to... There was all a palace and everything else where you could kip down and get a night's sleep and a cup of tea.
And that was similar to what Aggie Westerns would provide, wasn't
right it? Right, yes. You've got the same sort of thing. All these places that looked after the troops, you could go in there and you were warm That was the main thing. You're away from a service environment. You got a cup of tea. I don't know whether they had to pay for it or not. But that's what it was all about. You got some sort of sustenance and away from the service environment where people were kind to you. Whereas in the Navy, you were living amongst a lot of people who... Well, I wouldn't complain anyway about the way I was treated because I looked after myself. But basically, it must be hard to some kids, you know, who got into the Navy with, you know, First World War POs and couldn't understand the way they were could be treated. But if you knew that the way you were going to be treated, you could laugh at it. The one thing I could do with POs, you know, and even when I was at Whale Island, the warrant gunner there, and I was a touring, fairly senior, RNVR lieutenant, that CPO gunner would come to give me a bollocking and give me an hour's ordering in the night, but he'd come to me before I could say he'd laugh. You know, I got him beaten. He was dead in the water. But because whatever they tried, if you did it and you laughed about it, you're ahead of the game.
Were you frustrated in your time in Portsmouth? Because obviously you were wanting to get on the
train. I want to get going, yes. But you're in an environment, a survival environment, really, because you're being bombed, you had no money, you were in the Navy, you're waiting to go somewhere. And as far as I was concerned, I was going somewhere to fly. And so anything went before didn't matter. But I wanted to get there quickly. And I remember when I first went to Pompey Barracks, I said to there was a PO there. He was not an old PO. He was, how can I best describe it? Interwar PO. He was still had that same tang. Asked him how long it would be. He said, you'd probably be here in 6 or 7 weeks. 6 or 7 weeks? And they say they want pilots, you know. But that's the attitude, you know, you stick around. And in point of fact, I was only there, 3 or 4 weeks, I suppose, something like that, for the next course into Vincent, and went across to Vincent, and that was it. But it's dimming now. I had very acute memory of things that even went on in Pompey Barracks. The way we lived, for instance, in all hammocks. We had this traditional 18 inches of hammocks. It was so pre-war, you know. And you had to take your hammocks down and stack them in the racks all the time. And I don't know where we ate. I could not tell you now where we ate our food in Pompey Barracks. Though the messing system was Mestec system, so presumably we had bulk messing, but I couldn't tell you. But I survived anyway, but that's because you took... You took your hammocks down. Under normal circumstances, your mess table was underneath there. Now, I do not remember any mess tables being under those hammocks. I still got a mental picture of where we hung the hammocks and the general darkness in the place. You know, it was just like being inside Shipperley, the roof was pretty close to you and everything else. But I suppose I didn't spend much time in the hammocks as well. When you think about it, or the feeding, because when the air raids were on, we went to the air raid shelters under the deck, of course, and that was dangerous. Where they were three high, and they had paraffin heaters in there too. And if your blanket got on top of a paraffin heater, that caught fire. There was always fires in the place.
How would you find out about your drafting? Where would you go to find that?
Well, first of all, you get to know where the pay office is, and that's if you want a casual payment. You can get a casual payment on your paycheck anyway, but there's always a queue there. We must have had divisional offices. It must have been on some sort of centralised control. But again, it must have been amnesia, because my memory is normally very good. But I don't remember the detail of Pompey Barracks at all. As you see, is interspersed with this trip to look after the Catholic Church over the way. Then we were marching them down the prayer ground. Obviously, we had to stop and eat and be fed. And I cannot think. I can only get a mental picture of the old Victorian box for the troops, you know, the where you stayed.
Would they poster draftings? Would they poster drafting on a wall somewhere, or a notice board or something like that, so you knew what you were?
I don't know. I do not know. This is completely out.
Well, you were there for what, 3 or 4? You say 3 or 4 weeks.
I can't really say. I haven't a record of when I went to Vincent either, because that doesn't show in my logbook. But I know that I was at Vincent for the blitzes, the big blitzes in January, February. So I got there, and that was, what, an 8-week course, I suppose.
Can you tell me how the course started and what it involved?
What, the Vincent course? Right. St. Vincent was in the same style as Pompey Barracks on a smaller scale. H block was a block. You lived in dormitories with beds, and to wake up in the morning, the peer came along and lifted the bed up and threw you out. So that was a good indication of life generally. We had lectures in a lecture room. Because I remember going underneath the seats of the lecture room when the bombs were being dropped. We were out most nights. We were on call out for incendiary bombs, and we all had duty. I used to go with Petty. We're under a boat called Petty Officer Wilmot. Have you heard of him? Never heard of him. He done any Fleet Air Arm Boys at all? No? Am I the first one? Oh, bloody hell, they'll all tell you about Wilmot. Wilmot was the first time those lads had ever come up against a pre-war or a First World War PO. And he was one of the boys. He was one of these old-time, you know, he was caring, but rough caring. And you got under... don't forget, the people who went into Vincent were not like me. I'd been through it all. And they were going through what I'd been through in a shorter way, marching up and down, saluting, uniforms, everything else. But also quite a long course on mathematics, navigation, learning signalling, Morse code and flash signals, and the Navy generally. That started on a regular day at 6 o'clock in the morning. Everybody wakey-wakey and up and away he went. With parade first thing, as every time you went into barracks or a barrack situation, 6 o'clock in the morning, a full parade. And that happened at Ganges as well, of course. 6 o'clock in the morning, we're out there, and it was bloody dark, uncold, in full dress. So that, you know, brings a recall of another one, Vincent... we had the four blocks with observers at the... there was another observer course going through at the same time as we were, and I was at 24th pilot's course. Now, to tell you a quick story about that, I was on 24th pilot, Nodrog, Gordon Wallace, who was an observer, was on an observer course, and Gordon Dick, who was my pal who got in, he was on 16th course, so that he was 8 courses before me. I was trained as a pilot. I went to Canada, went all the place, came back. By the time I was flying, Gordon Wallace had been in the desert flying. He'd done a complete tour, and by the time I'd finished my flying, he had gone up to Arbroath, which will come on later, and I met him at Arbroath, and I was flying observers, stooging for Gordon Wallace, who was instructing observers on observing, and I was on instructing.